Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, we ask how thunderstorms are made and does it really rain more at weekends?
At the moment, we have very low confidence in predicting these type of events.
God goes green as these nuns get an architectural makeover.
It's quite stunning, the whole place. And it's so modern. There isn't a Gothic arch to be seen.
Plus,
what is non-orientable and lives in the ocean?
Having a laugh at the expense of science.
In our last Edinburgh show, we performed a sketch where we discussed the quantum mechanics behind Deal or No Deal.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. We'll be joined later by the Golden Voice Ian Sample, but right now we're here with Andrew Russell, who's a meteorologist at the University of Manchester. Andrew, welcome.
Hi there.
Did I pronounce that correct? Meteorologist?
Yeah, that's right.
Nothing to do with
right.
Meteors?
No.
No, weather. It is derived from weather, meteors.
Well, hydrometeors, So it's water droplets in the atmosphere.
Okay. Well, I've just shown my staggering and lack of knowledge on that front. But okay, you're a meteorologist at the University of Manchester. Now, I grew up, growing up in Manchester. I was in Manchester the other week for the Conservative Party conference, a rainy place, if ever I've experienced one. Is Manchester the best place to study thunderstorms and rain?
Well, I've not actually worked on any projects in Manchester, specifically looking at rain. From Manchester, we look at clouds and rain all over the world. Specifically, I've looked in Hampshire, which isn't particularly exotic, but they've got a brilliant radar dish there that we use to study clouds as they form. And Germany, more recently, I've been looking at how thunderstorms form as they go over the Rhine Valley.
So your main work, or one of your bits of main work, is to study how thunderstorms form. So give us a bit of a rundown on that.
Yeah, well, we're really interested in how severe precipitation events occur. So thunderstorms are the cause of a lot of those. In 2004, we saw the flooding in Boscastle, where no one was killed, but it was a really big precipitation event. And that's the kind of thing that we're interested in understanding more so that we can then predict those events using computer models. At the moment, the size of the grid that computer models have to chop the atmosphere up into is too big to actually see these storms. But as our computing power increases, we're going to be able to represent them much better. So now we need to get ahead of the game and understand the science better.
So run me through what happens in the cloud when it's going to start to create thunderstorms.
Okay, so yeah, your typical thunderstorm will occur in summer when it's very warm. So you'll get the ground warming up and you'll have a warm bubble forming. So that becomes buoyant. So it can rise in the atmosphere. And clouds all form basically when air rises. So as it rises, it expands and cools because the pressure drops off. And eventually, the water vapor within that air will saturate or condense, rather, and form a cloud. It's just the same process as your breath coming out on a cold day. And normally, you don't see the water vapor, but on a particularly cold day, the air coming out of your mouth cools and the water vapor condenses into water droplets so you can see it.
And what about the thunder? The lightning, rather.
The lightning is due to the really intense vertical motion that you get when a cumulonimbus cloud, a thunderstorm, is really well developed. So to feed that, you need really fast vertical updrafts. And what that does is when the hail particles within the top part of the cloud start bumping into each other, they'll knock electrons off each other. So you get a charge difference between the top of the cloud and the ground, and the lightning is where that charge is equalized.
How far in advance can you predict whether there's going to be a huge precipitation event or massive thunderstorms? So you mentioned Boscastle earlier. One of the problems was that wasn't predicted very far in advance, and so people couldn't get out of the way or do things about them. So how far can you predict them now?
At the moment, we have very low confidence in predicting these type of events. I don't think the Met Office would issue a weather warning for a very local region to say evacuate. Hopefully in the future, once the results of these projects are fed back into these more powerful models on better computers, we might be able to get, say, a 3-hour lead time for a local enough region for the emergency services to be able to prepare for the effects of these the flash floods that would occur, and perhaps to get people to prepare themselves, to put out sandbags or evacuate.
And so is this a case of producing better computer models, or is it a raw computing power issue?
It's both. Our understanding of the science almost lags behind the development of computing power. So when we couldn't resolve these things, we didn't need to know a lot of the fine detailed structure of the storms because we couldn't predict it anyway. But now that the computers are developing to the point where we can, we need to spend a lot more time and effort understanding the detailed structure of how these things work so we can predict them when we have the model capability.
I mean, most people will obviously, their interaction with meteorology will be the weather forecasts that we come across, and this country are obsessed with weather, either on websites or on the news. And sometimes they can be disappointing for people, can't they? If you get the Met Office saying in April, oh, it's going to be a barbecue summer, it's what they said this year, and then the summer turns out to be a bit of a damp squib, a lot of people say, well, these weather forecasters, they don't know what they're doing. Now, I know, and you know probably, that weather forecasts have got much, much better in the last decade. But why is it that they end up doing something that the weather forecasters tell us that won't happen?
Well, the atmosphere is fundamentally chaotic. The branch of maths, chaos theory, actually was developed by a meteorologist in America, Edward Lorenz, who, using a very simple model of convection in the atmosphere, realized that it was fundamentally unpredictable after, say, a week or two, simply because you can never get accurate enough observations to put into any method of predicting the weather to get an accurate forecast. So the errors that you're bound to have in the initial conditions start to blow up and then drown out the actual useful.
So your error bars are huge, and it could be any one of lots of scenarios.
Yeah, after 3 or 4 days, most weather forecasts we produce are noise. What happened with the seasonal forecast this summer is a little more complicated. The Met Office would run their weather forecast model many times at lower resolution, so with bigger grid boxes. And then if they ran it 100 times, say, and 60% of those models said it was going to be warmer and drier than average, then their seasonal forecast would be that it would be warmer and drier than average. And this was interpreted by the PR wing of the Met Office as a barbecue summer.
Well, I mean, apart from that one phrase, they didn't get it too badly wrong in the predictions, actually. So this is the interesting thing to point out about weather forecasts: they're probabilistic. So if someone says that it's a 60% chance of rain, well, there's a 40% chance that it might not rain. So it doesn't mean it's wrong. But how would you advise members of the public who don't realize how weather forecasts are produced to interpret what you see on a forecast or even a seasonal forecast?
Well, as far as the weather forecasts go, some types of weather are really predictable. Say, fronts moving past, where you have regions of cold air battling with regions of warm air that push the warm air upwards and produce big, what we call nimbostratus clouds, so big areas of rain clouds. They're quite predictable. What we were talking about earlier, the thunderstorms, the convective storms, they're not very predictable. So we're still trying to work out which types of weather are more predictable than others. And this is really coming out in the seasonal forecasts, in that not only is it a probabilistic forecast, but perhaps we also need to understand more about which of those forecasts are more likely to be right than others.
Yeah.
So a second level of probability.
How much better are weather forecasts now than they were 20 years ago?
Much better. A three-day forecast now is as accurate as a one-day forecast was, say, 10 years ago.
I'm thinking 1987 with those storms and Michael Fish telling us not to worry about them.
yeah, that wasn't the Met Office finest hour.
So if you're trying to understand the way that clouds form and how they precipitate into rain to try and predict when some calamitous event might happen, can you also use that information to predict what might happen if we wanted to do one of these geoengineering experiments, like, you know, putting sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere to create clouds that reflect away sunlight? Is it useful for that sort of project as well?
Yes, absolutely. One of the other suggested mechanisms of geoengineering is to put sort of self-powered boats in the southern Pacific Ocean that fire up sea salt particles, and they can seed big layers of stratocumulus cloud, which will then reflect away incoming solar radiation. So that's one suggested idea of engineering our climate.
And you could use the models that you've created to try and work out how big the clouds might get or that kind of thing. Or is that the too much at the moment?
There are certainly people doing this. And the focus on geoengineering at the moment is really exciting. It's a sort of new area of research to think about how we can change the climate in new ways. I imagine that most of them would be a disaster if we actually implemented them.
Okay, but, I was going to come to this. What do you think of it? Actually, you've told me you think it's a disaster. Why?
I think the consequences would be really hard to predict. We could get ourselves in a worse position where we have to carry on implementing these solutions. If we stopped, it would be an even bigger disaster than if we never started. But it's exciting research, and it has to be done to understand what would happen if someone did implement one of these.
So you're saying that, you know, it's hard enough to predict the weather in a week, so never mind what these man-made clouds might end up doing.
there's bound to be, you know, consequences that we wouldn't foresee.
We should do it anyway. All right, Andy, it's been fascinating. One thing I will ask you before we finish this podcast, and it's a very serious question, so I'm going to give you some time to think about it. But producer Andy wants to know, does it rain more at weekends? And I want you to hold your answer. Think about this, and we'll come back to it at the end. Andrew's part of the Noisemakers Project, and for more information on that, you can go to noisemakers.org.uk. Now, just quickly before we go any further, just part of our ongoing work to improve your podcast experience, for anyone using any of those iPhone iTouch thingies, bring up this podcast on your screen right now. Yeah, come on. We're waiting for you. Now, tap the screen. Now, you should have brought up some text. Yes, there it is, which gives you all the details you want about this program. Let us know if this works and what you think of it. Just thought you should know it's there. More developments, apparently, in the pipeline.
Science Weekly.
Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack.
Almost a decade after the Human Genome Project laid bare the building blocks of life, scientists have figured out how they work together to create a living person. About 25,000 genes that are needed to make a healthy human being were identified, but said nothing about how they combine to produce everything from hearts and minds to legs and livers. Now researchers in California have published what is effectively the first manual to show how genes are orchestrated inside cells. Many scientists believe the work will lead to new treatments for life-threatening diseases such as cancer and possibly mental disorders such as schizophrenia.
A pioneering expedition to the North Pole has confirmed that Arctic ice is thinner than expected. It heightens fears the region could be free of ice in the summertime within a few decades. The Catlin Arctic Survey found the area it covered consisted almost entirely of ice less than 1 year old. It used to contain older, thicker ice that formed over several years.
Scientists have established beyond doubt that in rare cases, cancer can be transmitted in the womb. It's after leukemia cells cross the placenta and spread from a 28-year-old mother to her unborn baby, defying the accepted theories of biology. But those behind the study stress the chances of any pregnant woman with cancer passing it on to her child are remote.
And finally, Kew Gardens has hit the target for its Noah's Ark seed bank. A pink banana completed the collection, which represents 10% of all the world's plant species. The banana, Musa itinerans, is the last of 24,200 species to have its seeds collected, dried and stored in Kew's Millennium Seed Bank. It's taken 17 years of work to get to this point.
The Guardian science correspondent Ian Samples now turned up to talk about a couple of their stories. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
Do you want to take us through the first one of those, the epigenome? This is the 25,000, well, the manual for the 25,000 genes that we have.
Yeah, we can always struggle for decent analogies with this one. But if you think of we all know the human genome was sequenced and published, if not in its entirety, but, you know, a decent draft of it was published in 2001. And that gives you 3 billion base pairs, these kind of pairs of letters of the human genetic code. So all of our cells, pretty much all of our cells, have this entire genetic code in. Now, the difference between, say, a heart cell and a muscle cell or a skin cell is they all have the same genetic code, but there is a level of detail on top of the genetic code which tells which gene should be switched on and to what level they should be expressed.
So what kind of information does this give to doctors or people working on treatments for diseases, and what kinds of diseases would this be useful for?
Well, there's a huge amount of interest in epigenetics in terms of cancer, and I'll tell you why that is. I mean, if you think of cancer, some of it is caused by certain gene mutations, so breast cancer with the BRCA1, BRCA2 genes. You can think of a number of other cancers which will have a number of genes associated with them. If you have certain variants of those genes, then your risk of developing that cancer is much higher. Now, that's fine. That's all in the genetic code, but you can also have a high risk of cancer if you have glitches in any of this epigenetic information. These, you can think of them almost as volume controls attached to all the genes. Whether they're down at zero means that gene is switched off, or it might be turned all the way up to a sort of spinal tap-ish 11, which means that that gene is full on. If you start causing problems in the epigenome, then some of these the expressions of those genes will be changed and you can get more high risk of cancer. I mean, a classic example is we've got a bunch of genes kicking around in our genome which act to be tumor suppressors, so they prevent cancer forming in our body. You can get changes happening in your epigenome which effectively silence those tumor suppressor genes by accident, which means that they don't do their job, so your chance of developing cancer is a lot higher.
So there's two other interesting bits to sort of epigenome research. One is, can you affect the way your genes work by things like diet or medication? And also, if you're if you do something to your genes or the way that your genes function through your own lifestyle, whether it's environmental pollution, smoking, whatever, does that get passed on?
Whether it's passed on to offspring and to what extent it's passed on to offspring is a really active area of research, and it's very controversial. There are some studies that suggest that one huge one which suggested that if a person's grandparents smoked a lot before they themselves reached puberty, then the grandchild would reach puberty sooner. And the speculation, and that's all it is that smoking affects the epigenome, which we know it definitely does. But these scientists were saying it's possible that some of that epigenetic information is inherited. It's inherited stably, passed down the line. And then in the grandchild, effectively, they're saying that the epigenetic changes are telling the body, look, you live in a toxic environment. You better reach puberty quickly. Otherwise, you'll never have offspring because you'll die beforehand.
And so what's the progress to trying to get those other 198 cell types mapped?
Well, The U.S. National Institutes of Health is really spearheading this, and they've chucked in $190 million, which they're casting around the world to groups who can do epigenome mapping. And all of those groups are looking at different cell types and disease cells as well. So this will start coming together over the next few years. And the research we're talking about today comes from the Salk Institute in La Jolla in San Diego. They're the first team to report. They're the first people to sort of come out with their bit of work. But the rest is ongoing. It's happening in parallel. And that should be coming out soon. Then it really gets down to the job of cross-comparing them, seeing how a skin cell in me compares with a skin cell in someone with some horrendous disease, unless I've got a horrendous disease I don't know about, and just finding out what the differences are.
Those lesions look slightly dangerous. Okay, well, I'm sure there's going to be more of this stuff in the future. Let's move on to cancer passing between a mother and a fetus. This was the story out of the Institute of Cancer Research, and it's an interesting sort of, I mean, this was suspected before, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, there have been a lot of cases where, well, I say a lot, I mean, it's a tiny minority, but in the literature, if you look, there are cases have been documented where scientists have suspected that a child has developed cancer after essentially catching it from their mother. Now, the hunch has been there because these things happen, and it just seems suspicious. So people have wondered whether that was the case. This is the first real proof that cells from the mother who developed cancer, and actually she was only diagnosed with the cancer, it was leukemia, after she had given birth, and she died shortly afterwards. This is the first case where they proved that that cancer triggered a different kind of cancer, a lymphoma in the baby, which appeared 11 months into that baby's life when that baby was 11 months old. And that baby is stable. But it was a really really fascinating bit of work, because this shows that cancer cells, leukemia cells from the mother, cross the placenta, establish themselves in the baby, cause a different type of cancer. And the way they found it out was they studied the cancers intently in the mother and the baby, and they found that they had exactly the same genetic modification, the same genetic glitch. But they know that that genetic glitch hadn't actually been inherited by the baby, so it had to get there by cells being given over from the mother.
Okay, well, let's finish up with something a bit more lighthearted. L-Cross, which was thrown into the moon last week, which you blogged. Did it go according to plan?
I was really excited to be live blogging this, because this was NASA chucking two, larger than fridge freezer size probes into the moon at more than 5,000 miles an hour. And in a sense, what's not to love? But when I was live blogging it, NASA was saying, oh, look, this is the impact. And they would, when they were describing it, you know, I was watching the images that they were feeding back from one of the second probe that was filming the first one collide. And I thought I'd identified the kind of plume of dust that was supposed to be kicked out of the moon's surface. And then I realized much later on, I mean, I said, oh, I can see the plume and all that sort of thing. Absolute nonsense. What I was looking at was the sun glinting off like a ridge of a crater. And the probe had actually gone all the way down the crater. And the only evidence of impact you could see was probably one pixel, and you couldn't even see that in normal visual like optics. You had to go to infrared.
So the plume wasn't anywhere near as big as everyone thought it was going to be.
No, well, there was no visible plume as far as we know. What seems very likely is that none of it rose up high enough out of the crater to actually glint in the sun. So you can't see it in visual wavelengths. But their sensors on the probes picked stuff up as they were going through it. So they picked it up, you know, from heat signatures and things like that. They know they went through something. It was a really interesting press conference, actually, that happened a couple of hours after the impact, where they were saying they were cagey, but they said, we know we've got good data, but we're not going to essentially tell you what it is. We're not going to tell if we've seen water or what we have seen. But they definitely picked up a load of shrapnel, basically, kicking off the
you know what
the
they saw,
crater.
They saw monolith.
They saw, do you think so?
They saw monolith. And or, they, instead of hitting the moon's surface, they hit a large, black, sort of rocky
EDAM
thing. And there's no dust. Of course, there wouldn't be any dust. Why would there be? Anyway, you can read about this on the blog, obviously. And all these other stories are also on guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
After 171 years in Worcestershire, the Benedictine nuns of the Covenants of Our Lady of Consolation have left their monastery. They've moved to a new residence in the North York Moors National Park, a new building that they insisted must remain as environmentally friendly as possible as they lead their quiet life of prayer. Among the £4.7 million building's green touches are solar panels to provide hot water, a wood chip boiler fueled by locally sourced trees, and a roof covered in sedum grass to better insulate the building and attract local wildlife. Our religious affairs correspondent, Riyazat Butt, went along for a visit.
Well, we've got our reed bed sewage system, so water, drain water, falls by gravity down to the septic tank, comes out of the septic tank and goes through a series of reed beds, and then it goes straight into the gill, so that saves us having an electrically powered sewage treatment plant. We've got our solar panels up there, so that when you start to heat your water, it's already 10 degrees or whatever above freezing. We've got our wood chip boiler, because we don't have gas here, and that is using timber, wood chips, which is a renewable fuel. Sedum are rock plants, basically, so they require very little earth. They don't require any earth to grow in. It's a sort of medium, and they don't require much water. They're very tolerant to drought and a lot of water. And so they cover the roof membrane with something, with plants, basically, which the bees love and insects love, and it's a nice thing to look out onto. And it stops, it reduces the amount of rainwater runoff because it's absorbed by the plants.
Not cheap, but I think it's an investment in the future. We were building a monastery for the 21st century, and yes, okay, they weren't cheap features, but they're going to pay for themselves in the long run, because obviously, oil is very expensive, whereas wood chip boilers are not as expensive to run as oil is. But also, it's much better for the environment. I mean, we're rejoicing in God's creation here, the beauty of the site, and what we want to do is give back to creation something that we have received. and we're not destroying it by burning oil and what have you.
You can read more about the Benedictine nuns at guardian.co.uk/environment.
Hello, my name's Steve Mould. I'm with my comedy partner Gemma Arrowsmith.
Hello, that's me.
Hello, we are Mould and Arrowsmith and we are Sketch Comics. When are we next performing, Gemma?
We're next performing at Sci-Fi London Oktoberfest 2009, which runs from the 23rd to the 24th of October at the Apollo in Piccadilly. And we're specifically performing anything called In Space, Everyone Can Hear You Laugh, which is on the 24th at 9 p.m. Do come along.
Sounds
good. Hilarious.
Yeah, sounds geeky.
We're very geeky. Geeky Sketch Comics. A lot of our stuff is about science, maths, grammar and that sort of thing. Things that make your blood boil but really shouldn't.
I think it's funny in the same way that anything's funny. If it goes wrong or if it's misinterpreted, then humour comes out of it. Like in statistics, if you get it wrong, you'll find out that the average human has one testicle. So when it goes wrong, it's quite funny.
It's true.
I mean, also, like, culturally, a lot of comedy is to do with culture, and I think science has its own culture. And scientists, and mathematicians especially, are strange individuals. There's a good joke, actually. I think it's good. A mathematician, a physicist, and an engineer were travelling through Scotland when they saw a black sheep through the window. And the engineer said, "Ah, I see Scotland's sheep are black." And the physicist said, no. "Some of the sheep in Scotland are black." And the mathematician says, no. "In Scotland, there is at least one sheep, at least one side of which is black."
So there you go.
That is the cultural difference between mathematicians, physicists and engineers.
That reminds me of our show, Field Study.
Ah, yes.
That was the first show we did in Edinburgh back in 2007 now. It was called Field Study. And it was about three scientists trying to discover the secret of comedy through performing these tests on the audience. And I think the humour basically came from the fact that you can't analyse comedy like that. In doing so, you're missing the point. You're missing the very point. I think comedy and science attracts obsessive, geeky people.
If you're a comedy nerd or a science nerd, you have a lot in common. Maybe.
Absolutely.
Oh, this is the other thing.
Give us another joke.
The other kind of maths joke is where you only get it if
you have a deep, deep understanding of maths.
What is non-orientable and lives in the ocean?
Don't know.
Mobius Dick. I mean, it's...
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Sort of. Stuff like
that's
that.
That's amazing. Hey, Steve.
Yes.
Can you tell us your joke about pie?
You really?
Yeah, please.
No.
Why not?
It's irrational. Dear. I mean, it's that sort of thing. I'll just go this way. What's the difference between the diameter and the radius?
I don't know.
The radius.
Wonderful.
Good. I've got some limericks for you.
Give us a limerick.
A mathematician confided that the Mobius band is one-sided, and you'll get quite a laugh if you cut it in half because it stays in one piece when divided. So there you go.
In our last Edinburgh show, we performed a sketch where we discussed the quantum mechanics behind Deal or No Deal, which, I mean, if that isn't a draw to come and see us, I don't know what would be.
Yes, absolutely. It's to do with the fact that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics says a lot about the state of something before it is observed, a bit like Schrödinger's cat experiment, which is a cat in a box. The only difference between Schrödinger's cat, which is a cat in a box, and Deal or No Deal is... that there's money involved and there's a twat presenting it. Can I say that? I don't know. There's an idiot presenting it. That's pretty. Twat's fine.
Twat's fine.
I think he's a nice guy.
He's not.
A dozen of gross and a score plus 3 times the square root of 4 divided by 7 plus 5 times 11 is 9 squared and not a jot more. Another one.
I'm glad you brought these.
Okay, good.
We do a lot of sketches about grammar.
Yeah, a lot of time travel, a lot of sci-fi stuff, a lot of paradoxes. Come along.
If you're the sort of person who sees a sign with an apostrophe missing or an apostrophe there where it shouldn't be and it bothers you, come and see us.
MouldandArrowsmith.com for more information.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's run through some of the comments following last week's Penisology podcast, a programming triumph of rude and childish responses to science, it says here. In case you missed it, make sure you go back and listen, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Here are some of the comments on the blog and the Facebook wall. Not in use says,
where do I collect my reward for listening to something I don't want to know?
Sounds to me like a rhetorical question. Jimmy suggests any further Penisology events be held at the Horniman Museum, which turns out to be in South London, and it seeks to encourage a wider appreciation of the world, its peoples and their cultures and its environments. Kanuki boasts,
for years now, I've noticed no women are interested in my Penisology.
Yeah. Pat Trichler from the University of Victoria says,
not that I don't miss Alok, but Nell, I dare say that giggle of yours brings some much needed sex appeal to the pod, whether the topic's dark energy or Penisology. Keep up the superb work, everyone, and Nell, drop us a line if you're ever in Vancouver.
Which I think's an offer Nell really can't refuse. And to finish us off, so to speak, if we're handing out awards for comments, here's the winner. From Eric Oldag at the Cuyahoga Community College, which I believe is in Ohio.
I agree with Pat. Nell's voice is very pleasing to the ears. I feel as though she would make a wonderful romance novel narrator. P.S. Just listening to this week's podcast made my penis hurt.
You actually read it out, didn't you? You went and read it out. Well, I feel sorry for the lady bedbugs personally, for that traumatic insemination. Have your say, either join our Facebook group or post a comment on the wall. You can leave your thoughts on the blog as well at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And on our new and improved blogs, your picture now gets posted alongside your comments. Hooray!
Science Weekly.
Back to our meteorologist now, Andrew Russell. Andrew, I asked you earlier about wet weekends. We're going to come to that right at the end. But before we do, tell us about the Manchester Science Festival. You're going to be doing some demonstrations there.
Yes, the Science Festival runs from the 24th of October until the 1st of November. It's the school half-term week. And there'll be events all over Greater Manchester aimed at all ages. I'm doing an event looking at rainfall in Manchester. So we're going to try and get people to make their own rain gauges and measure rainfall for 1 week. Trying to answer this question, does it rain more at weekends?
You need to collect the data so far, but what's your hypothesis?
Yeah, at the moment, I don't know the answer. The science behind this is that when clouds form, it's all about the condensation of water vapour. But water vapour can't spontaneously condense. It needs little particles in the atmosphere to grab onto to become a water droplet. These are typically, say, sea salt that's been brought up from the oceans or dust from the land. But it can also be pollutants from factories or cars. So obviously that has a weekly cycle because factories are more active during the week and more people commute during the week. So the link between human pollution or the emissions from human activity can affect the way that clouds form and then the rainfall.
Would that suggest that actually at the weekend it rains less because there's less of this pollution going on and less of the cars? Or am I missing something?
Well, no, that was initially what I thought. But what tends to happen if you have too many of these little particles, then you get more droplets that are smaller, so they don't fall out as rain. So that can suppress rainfall during the week.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Well, when do we get the results? I actually want to know what the answer is.
Okay, well, we're getting people to collect data during the week, Friday the 24th of October to Saturday the 30th of October. And then at the Science Festival itself, at the Museum of Science and Industry on Saturday the 31st of October, between 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock. People can just drop in on our session and look at the data we've collected, look at some of the historical data from the Manchester area to see if there's any patterns over much longer timescales. And hopefully we'll be able to come up with an answer.
Well, ring us up and tell us the answer to that. Andrew, thank you so much. Thanks to Andrew Russell from the University of Manchester. You can find out more information about him at andrewrussell.co.uk. And also the Manchester Science Festival. Details are at manchestersciencefestival.com. Thanks also to Guardian Science correspondent Ian Sample for popping in when he felt like it. Next week, it's all about uranium. Amir Axel joins us in the studio to discuss the scientific rivalry that created the nuclear age. We're also at the Science Museum as Energy and Climate Change Secretary Ed Miliband opens up a new exhibit there. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you can join our Twitter feeds too, Science Weekly and Guardian Science. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga Community College in Ohio, I believe.
Is that somewhere off Family Guy?
Quahog, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me say that again. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga Cameron. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga. Okay, one more time. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga Community College in Ohio, which I. No. From Eric Aldag at the. From Eric Aldag at the Cuyahoga Community College, which I believe is in Ohio.
Yes, Eric, who's presumably friends with Stewie out of Family Guy, says, just listening to this week's podcast made my penis hurt.